we set up with some images for the crowd?
We are. This, they'll come midway through.
All right.
So thank you. It's HMNY 2011 in the right directory. Hi, thanks for coming today, and thanks for inviting me to come and join you. I didn't know about the HMNY conference until this year, but I like the spirit of the invitation, and I really like the fact that this is organized by graduate students here in New York City, and if you are in that category, do not despair. You're actually one of the key change agents in global society. So keep up the good work, and it's a pleasure to join you. My talk is about actually kind of fitting in to the themes that Bill has introduced, and I'll be actually bringing up an old book of his that I like very much along the way. And so the title of my talk is Recentering the Political Economy of the Subprime Crisis, The Past and Future of U.S. Racial Inequality. I've had a chance to publish something in Historical Materialism about the political economy, the subprime crisis. And what I'm going to do today is briefly summarize that argument, but then indeed try to put it into a broader frame that makes contact with a lot of what Bill's talking about. Since we had five more minutes, I thought a couple of pictures might be nice. I should note that this thought process that I'm bringing you along on has been, I've been able to add the efforts of Lisa Mohanty and Jesus Hernandez as co-authors and co-thinkers, so I'm bringing in some sense all of our ideas to you. Okay, in several parts then. First, right now there's a huge debate about the causes of the subprime crisis in what they call in Australia the Great Financial Crisis. And there's one of the questions that's out there is it viral or systemic? And this idea of Robert Shiller and some of the economists, John Quigley and Rosen and others, is that it's basically kind of viral. The problem is that we're midway toward the creation of a modern system of finance, and one characterized by securitization, offloading, and proper pricing in markets of debt. And basically, we just lack some things in this system. In particular, we didn't have any early warning systems or any way for markets to evaluate how risky this paper was. And therefore, if we can get that right, find the right markets and the right ways to securitize all that, and then to have market-based monitoring, it'll work really well. That's one view, better regulation. Another view that comes out is so that's a, and that's a view, I should say, that the economists as a group, they disappear right from the analysis. You can go through Shiller's book or some of the other books and look up the words discrimination, race, inequality, and those terms, and you will find nothing. It's really rather remarkable. Now, in terms of people that do think that race matters or racial inequality matters, there's a book I'd like to call your attention to that just was published by Kathleen McCoy, or Patricia McCoy and Kathleen Engel, called The Subprime Virus, which is a very, very nice work. They are two activist lawyers, and they have been at the forefront of trying to call out people's attention since the mid-1990s that there was this subprime lending was exploitative and predatory. It was part of a broader pattern of predatory lending, and they couldn't get anybody's attention nor access to the data. They've now put it all down in a book that's really a gripping read, and there I should say that they're the ones that use the word virus, though, and kind of as lawyers, perhaps reflecting the legal perspective, their notion is, had there been, you know, Washington was asleep at the regulatory switch, had they paid attention, all this could have been avoided, kind of. So again, a perspective that doesn't surprise us from, you know, two very passionate advocates of the bar. Another view that we see begins to move toward the idea that it's systemic. And I want to mention a very important article that was put out by Ruge and Massey, Douglas Massey and I think Thomas Ruge, in the American Sociological Review a couple of months ago, maybe more like 8 months ago, in which they basically have a wonderful review of all the literature on the foreclosure crisis and on the subprime, and basically say it all comes down to racial segregation. Now, you know, that's And if you know Massey's work in sociology, you know, he's been working for years with Denton and others on American apartheid. And so he really kind of sees this as the fruits of the many years long racial separation in US society. Now, you know, what's missing here is several things, and this is what we're going to kind of focus on. For the sociologists, it's all about racial segregation, where there's really no attention to mechanisms. And for economists, it's all about oversight of the markets. And actually, my team and I, we borrow from the feminist economics literature, where they have introduced the notion that you need not just micro and macro analysis, but you need meso analysis as well. And that's where you have mechanisms, you focus on the mechanisms that structure and channel social power through markets. So it's not just how the markets work in supply and demand, but basically what's going on, what's behind that, and then of course you go up to the macro level. And I think this is very, very important in this case. So we're going to focus a lot on the mechanisms here. Now, to just briefly reprise my, now we're going to just like a couple of minutes on the political economy, the subprime crisis, which was published a couple of years ago in Historical Materialism. In my analysis, there were kind of three things going on, and I'll be really brief. One is that there was an offloading of there was a crisis in the regulated banking system, coinciding in Bill's discourse with the kind of crisis in the last SSA, and there was a reformulation of banking strategy. Again, without detail, what essentially came out of that was there was the birth of securitization on a broad basis, initially safely through mortgage-backed securities markets underwritten by the federal agencies, and then more adventurous. And further, the banks really began to split out customer bases in which they'd not been able to compete and to identify the desirable customers, the upscale retail customers, and to kind of focus on their attention on those customers who were able to leave for other non-bank savings and other venues. And what that did was to take the non-desired customers, the poor and the working class customers, and basically force them to pay their true value for the banking services they got. The second component then is of the crisis was the transformation of racial exclusion. Now again, there's a huge history, but back in the day, we had the legacy of redlining and discrimination in minority neighborhoods especially, wherein people couldn't get loans and especially couldn't get loans to own homes. And given the centrality of loan, and when I say people, especially minorities in throughout the land, and given the centrality of home ownership our U.S. system of capitalism, especially for people to accumulate wealth and some kind of a hedge and be able to start businesses, send their kids to school, et cetera, this was a crucial disadvantage and was a kind of strangulation of wealth creation in U.S. inner cities. What happened in terms of transformation, so the community reinvestment movement always talked about let's end redlining and discrimination and allow minorities into the credit markets. But there was then a transformation of this situation as financial exclusion became financial exploitation. Starting in the late 80s, getting into the 90s especially, that was the decade when, with the growth of securitization, with computerization, and so on, there were more, and especially the growth of low-income working populations, deindustrialization going full force, and more migrants and immigrant workers, so that there were remittances, there were people who couldn't afford bank accounts, there were many money orders and many transfers to be done, and these were markets in which banks had very little market share and they wanted market share, so they basically created instruments for being able to tap into these markets, key among which were predatory loans. Predatory loans were hyper-optimized as loans that were certain to crash and burn people longer term, even medium term, but in the short term would be profitable. And they did that by being sure there were high rates, there were high fees, high penalties, lots of collateral. So essentially you take from people what they had knowing that you were going to trash them. I should say that was one of the complaints that McCoy and the other lawyer, Engel, make in their book, taking a lawyer legal perspective. They're trying to argue that that's wrong. They lost that argument. Now, the mega banks got interested, and basically they began to look to buy some of these subprime lenders. And of course, key among the predatory loans was subprime lending. Subprime lending for on houses really started, at least in California, where I was working with fair housing advocates, in our minority neighborhoods, where people that were lucky enough to own homes in minority neighborhoods were deluged with offers for second mortgages. Often these are families where there were high unemployment among kids, lots of people in prison, unwed mothers and so on, people that needed money, and they were preyed on by people in this situation. That then led to, so that was just so the predatory lending was there. And the trigger for the crisis was then, as the housing price bubble comes along, we have a situation in which basically you have available a mechanism for high-risk mortgage lending that is always used disproportionately for people of color, but spreads more broadly and is used widely as basically a working class that no longer has the means to keep, that has a shrinking income, is chasing housing whose prices are rising ever higher. And essentially, how you span that gap? You span it by giving them speculative loan instruments. So for example, in California, 2005, 2006, one half of the mortgages made were with zero down payment, to give you just, one stat on how crazy things got in that crazy, situation of the subprime boom and housing boom. Okay, the third factor I want to say that's part of the global, part of the crisis is the global imbalance. And we have a guest from France here who's going to talk a lot more about that with great distinction later today. But one of the things about the imbalance that I want to call your attention to is that the twin deficits of the 80s led to the current account deficits of the 90s and the 2000s. And that actually opened the way to the U.S. having consistently a capital account surplus, which in turn means that the U.S. became a global liquidity sink. Not surprising that we had such a growth of securitization when essentially all of our markets were there looking for ways to channel funds that were coming up as a reflection of our inability to compete globally. The aftermath is then we have the foreclosure, the crisis. And at this point, what I'd like to say is, I'll go up and show you pictures in a couple of minutes, but let me kind of get through my argument and then show you pictures that illustrate the case. We have then the subprime crisis. That turns into a global financial crisis. And here in the U.S., and I'm going to keep the focus on racial inequality, it turns into a foreclosure crisis. Just as, and again, without showing you the lots of the statistics that are available, just as the subprime lending was focused disproportionately on communities of color, so too the foreclosure crisis is as well. In both cases, I have to tell you, there's kind of a question about why is it that's something that's going to affect about 8 million U.S. households. Let's call it 25% of U.S. people. Call that about 7 to 8% of the population will be losing his house or has lost his house in this crisis. It's kind of amazing, close to 10%. And yet, why is it that that's invisible and it's been invisibilized? And I came up with a list of five things. One thing is that it's disproportionately impacted minority areas. Wiley and some of his co-authors have talked about pointed out the Black Belt in the U.S. South, all these cities that are predominantly African American, where there's a huge concentration, first of subprime loans, now of foreclosures, but it's also true, throughout minority areas around the country. Secondly, there's a disproportionate impact on minority and female borrowers, and again, those are invisibilized populations, especially in the mass media and policy discussion. Third factor for this crisis being invisibilized is that we have no publicly maintained databases on foreclosures. We had the same problem with subprime loans. You could get something that was kind of like subprime loans through the HMDA databases, but it was not really right, and you couldn't do the good detailed analysis you really wanted to do. And we now have that problem doubled for foreclosures. The only data that's even collected is collected by the realty companies that are predators or reselling properties that people are losing. So it's a hell of a situation. That's part of the invisibility. Fourthly, a fourth factor in the invisibility of this crisis, and I've attended some of the mass sessions and out in California, and if you haven't done that, go. Because what you will see is people who are filled with shame. And the counseling that they're getting is horrible. It reinforces the shame. I've heard things said to people like, do you know that have you been going to the mall? Have you been getting your hair done? Have you been going to the restaurant and out to eat? You know you got to change, this type of discourse. Being said to people along the way to counseling them, making them feel like human garbage, because they're the people who weren't able to keep their piece of the American dream, right? So like playing that card big time and then saying, if you reform yourself, maybe the Obama program is there for you. It's ridiculous. But this shame factor is also one reason, I think, why we don't see people in the streets. And if you think about the way that there's kind of communal policing of appearance, especially you geographers, in the way the subdivisions go these days, where you're supposed to keep up your lawn and maintain appearances and not park your tractor trailer out in the sidewalk, those kinds of things all have manifestations, because then basically it's about you didn't do your part to be one of the good neighbors. You're one of the unworthy, and you're one of the undeserving poor now. Get out. And so that's the fourth factor. The fifth factor is the demonstrated power of the mega banks, connecting with Bill's financialization argument. The inability of the government to even think about forcing a cram down on the banks illustrates their power. Now, final section of my talk, then maybe a couple pictures if there is time. What about the future of racial inequality with all of this? Well, keep in mind now that this stripping of assets, this loss of wealth, is occurring in markets that are in which minority home ownership was the policy in the Clinton administration. That's after Reagan stabbed rental housing in the back, assisted by Carter before him. Remember the Section 8 program and all that nonsense. And then public housing being disowned, all the subsidized housing being blown away, and then being replaced by the HOPE programs, where everybody's supposed to be a homeowner, and we're going to go from 67% to 72%, and that was under President Clinton. And of course, Bush just stamped that because that was all pro-financial market. Well, all that BS, all that garbage of housing policy is now in tattered ruins, and we've got no plan for anything else. But those tattered ruins of homeownership that people could not maintain, now people losing their homes as their working class incomes disappear through joblessness and other crises around the country, these problems now mean that we're going to have a whole generation of minority homeowners who are going to lose their wealth systematically. And in places like California, New York, and other in Florida, Texas, we're talking about people, essentially the future of sort of the next generation of entrepreneurs. Now, how to think of it, the thing is, we can think about those being foreclosed, and in some sense, minority communities as the losers in this, in some sense. The whole working class loses, but especially people of color. And how to think about this, and I'm what occurred to me, and here's why I'm going to get back to Bill's book that I have loved from the first moment I saw it. 1971, Political Economy of the Black Gutter, if I remember the title. And here's why I'm bringing it up. I think that these losers offer a demonstration effect. And basically, the idea is could they restore discipline to the accumulation process? Now let's go visit the argument that was featured in Bill's book, because I want to say it didn't work before and it's not going to work now. In the 1960s and 70s, Political Economy, Black Ghetto, you have minority workers that are segregated in cities. They've been brought to the north and western cities during World War II as labor supply. But then as Johnny came marching home, and as we began to have shifts in American capitalism, especially the white flight, those workers were workers that were not needed. And so in classic work by Hal Barron and others, the black ghetto, as it was called, then became a labor reserve. Same thing was true if you go back and look at Rudy Barreto's work in the Political Economy of the Southwest. And basically, so this minority reserve labor was there. And the idea somehow was that having a reserve labor force with high unemployment, right, could that be a source of discipline on white unionized workers who were largely fleeing the suburbs? Well, the answer was no. Because essentially, you know, what you needed to do was to discipline those white workers directly through deindustrialization. The contradictions and rigidities in our social, spatial, racial inequality just don't allow that kind of communication across the working class. We're too divided. Now, we might imagine today high foreclosure, high minority neighborhoods as having, in effect, a disciplinary effect on other debtor workers and homeowners. So, you know, are you in a neighborhood now with high foreclosure rate, or is it relatively a good neighborhood? How about the new renters there? How about the empty houses? And how about the vandalism? Is it okay or not? But, you know, once again, I think the spatial mismatch between the good and bad areas is too profound, divided in large part by race across the many dimensions. If you were to go with me to some of the Southern California cities, if we were to take a ride through the San Joaquin Valley, through Sacramento, through Stockton, through Madera, through towns like that, Merced, you would see that the racial divide is written all over, even the expansion of the housing supply in the midst of the housing boom, and that remains as the thing comes back crashing down. So you'll see, so what do you see then, I think is, and I'm gonna speculate a little bit, we'll see a steady loss of vibrancy in our public institutions. We'll see, you know, maybe California is a trendsetter where basically an older white-dominated voter bloc is now presenting the resource renewals that will be needed to renegotiate a high growth and accumulation path. We need more money for schools, we need infrastructure, we need other projects, but at this point, the privatization of gain and socialization of losses is resulting in the destruction of the growth-enhancing safety net and growth-enhancing projects of the government and the safety net sponsored by the government. The U.S. welfare state is not going to rise up at this point as we see it and help out. So, you know, essentially, we're now going to see some reversals, I think, in even the capacity of the state to restore. What I think that means is something like a favelization of some areas in residential areas in the United States, areas that become more and more informalized with worse and worse services and worse life chances for their kids. In Brazil, everybody can go to school, but in the public schools, they say the teachers pretend to teach, and I'm speaking on favelas there, right? The teachers pretend to teach and the children pretend to learn, but if you want to go into the nearly free, competitive public universities, you'd better have a private school background or some other supplement if you want to get in, because the public school will not prepare you. Now, in some favelas in Brazil, they are taking action to try to train their young people and get them into universities, but it's a desperate struggle. Meanwhile, ironically, the other piece of where global capitalism is going, at least vis-a-vis race and the, you know, pulling away from the situation here, is while we see decline in many of our neighborhoods in this nation, unless things change, right, is the banks hunting for global profits. And where are they going? Actually, speaking of Brazil, they're looking for new markets. We see a competition to create new forms of financial instruments in these other markets, at the very high end, to see Wall Street opening up, which won, right? Which won as Bill said, it wasn't the end of neoliberalism, it was kind of the triumph of the financialized neoliberal social structure of accumulation. And not only that, but just to say that, you know, chickens come home to roost. In Brazil, those banks are not just interested in opening up exciting new equity markets so that we can trade derivatives on the shares of Petrobras, etc. But in addition, we're seeing unbelievable rates of growth in consumer credit targeted at what would here be the lower working class, but which is there proudly called the new middle class. And just last week, the big bank Itaú in Brazil, the third largest, proudly said in an article in the Financial Times that it, despite the government's effort to cool things down, to avoid an inflationary problem that actually they are going to maintain their 20% projected credit growth rate for this year. So we're at a point that's a very confused point, and all indications are that our legacy of racial inequality will not end in a triumph of universalized home ownership, but that we will once again be in a spatialized, racialized nexus of crisis, confusion, and division in our working class, that it will be the task of progressive theory to overcome. Let me show you just this one picture here, and you've been staring at this, but I just want to show you, this is looking in the Survey of Consumer Finances. This shows you, basically, this is like the lowest quintile, and then like the, and there's the middle quintile. So this is just in the, you know, this every three years the Feds do this thing on who's got what money, and it's got some issues, but it's one way of slicing it. And essentially, what I want you to do, I just average everything from the late 80s to the early 90s. We don't have 2007 on here, but what I want you to see is these bars on the left are debt. Percentage, average percentage rates of debt, mortgage debt and non-mortgage debt, just the way in which the lower working class was targeted. The poor and the working class were targeted. And notice as well that the asset growth didn't exactly keep up. To the contrary, and of course this doesn't even take into account some of the kinds of stuff that would be going on more recently. One other picture, and then I'll be quiet, is this. I got some others because I got excited by having the possibility of showing you some pictures. But let me show you, actually, the previous. Okay, what we got here is the following. So we're going to have two pictures. One's going to be for females, and one's going to be for males. Now, what's going on? Okay, we take, this is Jesus and Lisa and I doing this work. We take, first of all, 2005 data. So the height of the craziness, the subprime craziness. And this, basically, this is kind of a response to this argument of, like, is it all about racial segregation, okay? All right, now, what you do here is say, we're gonna start with the least percentage non-white residents, almost none, to, like, the most, okay? Chopped up that way. So we're getting more and more minorities in space as we go across the page here. And then, basically, we separate out the borrowers by type. And basically, what you see here is that we have Asian females, white females. Basically, the percentages are then what percentage of the mortgage loans for home acquisition that you got were subprime loans. Okay, so you know, so what you see is that black women, for example, got in the most white areas, 41% of them got subprime loans, and in the most segregated areas, 54%. Okay, so just notice the range, 41 to 54. Latino women, you're looking at 31 up to 44, then down to 36, 35. Okay, now with that thought in mind, keep the black women with 41 to 54 in mind, and white women 22 to 31. Kind of keep those numbers in your mind. Now let's look at men. Did it flip? No, okay, wait, I gotta do this one here. There we go. Okay, now let's look at men. Once again, what do we see? Well, first of all, we see that we have white males, 16% up to 23%. So even if you're a white male buying a home in the most minority neighborhood you can find, which there are some, right? We have some words for that. You are unlikely to get a subprime loan, even the height of subprime in the housing price craziness season. If you're a black woman, whether you're buying in a white neighborhood, or right, and the same thing for a Latino woman, you're going to be much more likely to get a subprime loan. And by the way, if you're a black man, like black women, you are almost, you know, much, much more likely to get a subprime loan than any other of the components of the market. So, you know, there's this perverse intersection between the mechanisms that are designed to extract income and wealth from people, the inequality across space, inequality that's embodied in our racialized bodies and gendered bodies, and the ways that this all plays out to create this super crisis of the U.S. working class. Thanks very much for your attention.